This is part two in a three-part series. Please listen to part one before continuing with this episode. This episode contains discussion of violence, murder, and crime scenes. Listener discretion is advised. This is The Fall Line. When we last left off, an unknown killer had struck in Atlanta for 3 months running, twice in Adams Park and once in West Manor. Three couples, LeBrian Lovett, Veronica Hill, Deidre Tatum, Dennis Langston, Gordon Whitfield, and Diane Collins, had been attacked by a gunman. Only three of the young people survived. All had been shot at close range with a very particular kind of ammunition, Hornaday Wadcutter 38 caliber bullets, designed for target practice. Lab examiners felt it was likely that the bullets had been fired from a Colt 38. The couples were all local to the Southwest Atlanta area, all young Black men and women, and had gone parking in the local lovers' lanes on Friday or Saturday nights. But that's where the connections ended. They didn't know each other. Deidre and Dennis, they were in high school. Gordon was in the military. Diane was finishing cosmetology school. Veronica and LeBrian, the eldest, each had young children. The gunmen seemed most interested not in who they were, but what they represented, young lovers. His motivation for hunting them was what the police were still trying to understand. And different theories were posed. According to our sources, everything from relationship problems to religious zealotry to copycat killing was on the table. With the movie The Town That Dreaded Sundown still playing in theaters, thousands in Atlanta had just been introduced to the Texarkana Moonlight Killer. That uncaught murderer, he'd killed at Lover's Lanes too, 29 years before. An FBI profiler had suggested to the Atlanta Police Department that if the gunman in Atlanta was inspired by that film, he would be young, no more than 25, not 36 as we said last time. But the FBI didn't indicate how likely that inspiration might be. The profiler had other observations, too. Per the APD's files, the suspect would be somewhere between the ages of 25 and 50, and he would live in the area where he hunted. The FBI special agent also suggested that the gunman would be single, though, quote, a marriage could not be ruled out, and that the gunman would have some form of paranoid schizophrenia. We have no details on how or why that final conclusion was drawn. Though schizophrenia is still poorly understood by our culture in 2021, it was doubly so in 1977. In part three of this series, when we look at suspects and dig deeper into this profile and a second one developed by a local professor, we'll hear from an expert who can shed light on just how useful this kind of information might have been. After the three shootings, January, February, March, all 28 or 29 days apart, the Atlanta police did have a few solid facts to go on. There was the ammunition, the Hornaday bullets, and they'd spent weeks tracking down every buyer in the state. Most of the target ammunition had been shipped to law enforcement offices and prisons for training, but some was sold out of gun shops, and they had the task of following up on each one of those sales. And in 1977, there was no quick way to search through those names. Detectives had to visit each shop, collect each piece of information, cross-check driver's licenses, and move on, one person at a time. It was arduous, and it would take months. And it would not necessarily lead to the killer, who could have gotten the ammunition out of state, or stolen it, or, as retired APD Lieutenant Danny Yagan told us last episode, taken it from a target practice range. If the gunman was a member of law enforcement, he would have had easy access to do that. If he was a friend or a relative, it would have been easy too. And someone who worked at the range would have also been able to pocket it easily enough. The possibilities probably felt infinite. Detectives did have a very basic description of the shooter. One of the survivors, Gordon Whitfield, had seen him. Gordon had just returned to Atlanta from a tour of duty with the Army, and he'd just proposed to his girlfriend, Diane Collins. They'd barely had time to celebrate their engagement before they were attacked at Adams Park at 12:45 a.m. on March 13th. Though Gordon was shot twice, in the head, he survived to give police a basic description. The gunman was a black male, somewhere in his 20s or 30s, with a fairly muscular build. He'd been wearing a light-colored knit cap, yellow or white, and had assumed a crouched stance as he aimed into the car. Diane, Gordon's fiancée, had died as a result of the attack. That crouched stance, a posture that retired APD Lieutenant Danny Agan described to us as a two-hand crouch position, a shooting stance wherein a gunman holds a weapon with two hands and drops down low to the ground, reducing the surface area of the body to make a smaller target. That stance was taught to law enforcement and to many security guards who received weapons training. And that, plus the ammunition, led APD to look at current and former law enforcement officers throughout the state as possible persons of interest. And that stance could also be seen in hundreds of television shows and movies, too, as ubiquitous then as a side-held pistol was in the late 90s and early 2000s cinema. So it was a lead, but it wasn't definite. The killer could have law enforcement or military training, or be a family member of either. Or they could simply watch a lot of television. But combined with the ammo, well, the APD was going to follow that trail. Meanwhile, the families of the victims and survivors waited for news. To our knowledge, they weren't aware of each other in the early months of the investigation. The fact that a gunman was hunting in the lovers' lanes of Atlanta, in its parks, had not been made public. A few people outside the police force knew, city officials, a few journalists. But the news reporters had been asked to hold their stories until a stakeout could be staged that April in hopes of drawing out the killer and trapping him. That idea didn't sit right with Ken Willis, a reporter with the Atlanta Constitution. Ken was only 25 when the Atlanta Lovers Lane murders began, but he'd already been reporting on Georgia for more than a decade. Ken's backstory is fascinating. He was hired in junior high to work as a sports stringer for the Macon Telegraph, and then he wrote their obituaries as a high school student. He worked as a correspondent for the Atlanta Constitution during college. The paper actually gave him a scholarship that allowed him to attend the University of Georgia as he worked in the field. When he left UGA, Ken headed straight to Atlanta to work for the Constitution full-time. In 1977, he was on the crime beat. That meant he spent a lot of time hanging around the downtown police precinct, which he told us was once located where part of the Georgia State University campus stands today. Those familiar with the area will know it as near the Waffle House on Piedmont Avenue. Ken told us he generally had a good relationship with the homicide detectives and with Lieutenant W.K. Perry, who ran the squad at the time. Perry was known for being extremely competent, extremely thorough, and from what we've been told through the years, very no-nonsense. Not someone you'd want to be on the bad side of, either. As we told you last episode, the crime rates in Atlanta were on a steep rise in the late 70s. By 1979, our city would once again have the highest murder rate in the United States. So Ken Willis's job kept him busy. We spoke with Ken this August and asked him about his recollections of the Atlanta Lovers Lane murders. Although he left the Constitution in 1983, he has very clear memories of the crimes. After all, he was the reporter who broke the story. But in January 1977, he had no idea what was to come. That's when he encountered the story of LeBrian Lovett and Veronica Hill, the first victims of the Lovers Lane killer.
When I first heard of them, it was the night of January the 16th, 1977. My weekend duty was to cover the police and crime in the Atlanta area. And there's so much to cover in the city of Atlanta that my routine was to go by the homicide squad office and talk to Sergeant Bolton, and he would tell me whether there were any murders or aggravated assaults, mostly murders. And so the night of January the 16th, he said, well, we have kind of an interesting one. We had two people found shot in a car. Now, it was freezing cold. It was one of the coldest nights I remember in Atlanta. He said they'd found two naked bodies in a car, and the people apparently had been shot in the park, and the car had rolled down the hill and hit a sign or something like that. And he said, and the heater didn't work in the car. So I wrote a little story about it, but you can imagine that stuck in my mind, that here were two people who were having sex on one of the coldest nights in Atlanta history in a car that had no heater. And I said, so what do we think happened? And he said, well, we think it's a triangle, a domestic triangle, but we're not sure. Occasionally I would ask him if they'd ever solved it, and he would say no. Then in March, mid-March, I'm walking into the police headquarters. They had four women, mostly women there all the time, answering phones for an administrative way, and they were directing calls and so forth. And I had befriended some of them by buying them coffee and that kind of thing. And one of them motioned me over, and she said, you might want to know that they've misplaced a murder in the burglary file. And I said, oh, okay. So I went and found the file, the third shooting. And sure enough, they had misplaced it. I went, confronted Sergeant Bolton, and he kind of flipped out. And he said, well, actually, you didn't know about the second one. And I said, what second one? So that began a process where I said, we've got to run this story. We've got to do something with this. And he said, well, you need to talk to Lieutenant Perry about that. And I said, what's there to talk about? And so I called Lieutenant Perry at home. It was Sunday night. And he said, yeah, you can't run that story. And I said, well, excuse me, I don't work for you. And he said, well, you'll never see the inside of our police station again if you do that. And I said, well, whoa, I can't make that decision on my own. So the managing editor and the assistant managing editor became involved. And I didn't think we should hold the story, but they agreed to hold. The police had a theory that the killer struck every 28 days or every fifth weekend. And that, of course, raised issues about being tied to somebody's menstrual cycle. And they said that the killer would strike in one of these two locations on that time cycle. And I thought it was pretty flimsy, but I'm no policeman. So I had a really good source very high up in the police department who had lots of experience. And I went to see him, and I said, is this baloney, or is it valid? And he said, it's baloney. He said, the truth is, we don't know where in the hell this guy's going to strike next. And so I argued with my editors, we should not hold this story. They decided to do it. And the quid pro quo with Perry was that he would be open with us about what was going on, that he would tell us about what was going on. And so he did one time, he consented to an interview, and you see a lot of that interview in the story that I eventually published. But after that, he shut us down, and he wouldn't tell us anything. And I became convinced that if there was another murder that they didn't solve, they wouldn't say squat. And so I spent every day off in the police station, just hanging around, hoping to see any commotion or any hubbub that might happen in case there was another murder, because they changed frequencies. they quit telling us anything.
During that time, after the third shooting in March, which resulted in the critical assault of Gordon Whitfield and the murder of Diane Collins, APD planned a series of stakeouts. We weren't able to speak with the officers directly assigned to the case, but it's likely the change frequencies Ken mentioned had to do with the focus on secrecy. They wanted to limit, as much as they could, access to the plans for Adams and West Manor Park that April. The two parks where the gunman had previously struck were probably considered the best place to lay a trap for him again. Of course, if he was law enforcement, something that APD had considered, there was always the chance that he'd have access to that information anyway. But it was only one possibility of many, and the stakeouts were considered an essential step in trying to catch the killer. They had very little on him, the bullets, a very general description, and they needed more. Retired APD Lieutenant Danny Agan, who you heard from last episode, participated in the stakeouts in the parks. Like many other detectives, he was pulled off his normal beat, narcotics, to aid in the investigation. It was truly all hands on deck. He spoke to us this summer about the experience.
The stakeouts occurred in April of 77, and the timing of the stakeouts was coinciding with the probable time that this guy was going to strike next. What I recall, and then I've read since then, is the first shooting was the 16th of January. The second one was about 2 weeks into February, and then the third one was 2 weeks into March. By this time, the pattern had been clearly established, and there was no question that this was a serial offender, and the assumption was, if he's going to do it again, he's going to do it again, and we need to be ready. So the first I heard about it was, you're going to be on a detail this weekend. This was the preparation for it. I pulled available detectives from expendable units such as narcotics, vice, intelligence, other available people that they could come up with to stake out two parks on, I believe it was Friday, Saturday, and Sunday nights. We would start at, say, an hour or so after sunset and then go until about 3 o'clock in the morning. The notice that we had that we were going to do this was like, show up tomorrow, this is where you will report to work, and we showed up and then we were briefed about what was going on. And there was a degree of secrecy instructed in all this. Don't tell everybody what you're doing. This is what the situation is. This is who we're looking for. This is what we're trying to do, is catch this guy. So that was my introduction to the stakeout. This was a big operation. Two parks, same nights, two individuals in two cars, male and female officers, acting as bait. The cars were fitted with bulletproof steel plates in the door panels. There was plexiglass installed inside. I don't know if the plexiglass was by itself or put up in addition to the regular glass. It was two just regular, plain, unmarked, non-police looking vehicles that were used. One of them, in fact, was an undercover car that the narcotics unit used. It was a 71 or a 72 Ford Maverick, blue in color. And it's just nondescript, crappy little car. And this was one of the cars that they used for the stakeout. So you had two officers in a car wearing body armor, pretending to be making out, trying to draw this guy out. And then within a short distance nearby, you had two officers in a dumpster, marksmen, SWAT officers, watching close. Everybody's in radio contact with each other. They're watching and they're ready to spring into action if this guy comes up and pulls a gun. The plan is they're going to shoot him. This isn't going to be one of these police freeze moments. If a man walks up to the bait car and pulls a gun, he's going to get shot. I had a sent your compilation of reports to one of the guys I used to work with. He was on one of the stakeouts too. We were talking and he related this story to me. I had not heard this before, but one of two of the guys in the dumpster were watching and they see a man start approaching one of the vehicles. And as he gets closer, he's kind of like crouching around, sneaking around, walking up unobtrusively, watching what's going on inside. And then he gets close to the car, fumbles around with his clothes, and then pulls out his penis and starts masturbating. And this is just what you would expect in a lover's lane type of situation in an urban area. There's going to be guys out here walking around, looking into cars. This guy was probably very close to getting shot and didn't even realize it. And of course, that if what I'm saying actually happened the way it happened, that says a lot for the mental control that the officers inside the dumpsters had to exercise, the restraint that they had to use to make sure that they were not about to do something that they couldn't take back.
We asked Danny how difficult it would be to fully secure a park, considering all the ways that it might be accessed.
Multiple entrances in the park, that was an issue. You've got to kind of direct this guy to go in the direction you want to do. So I think maybe they had some kind of construction equipment or something set up blocking one of the entrances, which blocks one of the exits, which makes it a little bit easier to know which direction he's going to go. Of course, not knowing how he got to the park, where he entered the park at. Did he walk in? Did he drive to a location and then park and then walk a few blocks to get in the park? I mean, all of these things are unknown, so you're kind of doing a scattergun approach to determining what's the best way to catch him. In the event that he gets away from the immediate area, then you had perimeter cars and then you had chase cars. I don't know how many perimeter and chase cars there were, but I was in one of either one of those. I can't remember which designation my position was, but we were about a mile and a half or so away from the park. Myself and another detective sitting, listening to the radio, waiting for something to happen. And this is where we sat. We didn't get out and go goof around. I mean, best you could do would be go off in the bushes and take a bathroom break. But you sat there the whole time. And this was what we did, 3 days running, two or three weekends in a row, waiting for this guy to show his hand and try to shoot again. And of course, nothing happened.
Did that make people in the department start wondering if it was indeed someone in the department?
I think it maybe added to that belief or theory, but it didn't really define it. I think people were already thinking this could be a police officer. So the fact that nothing happened maybe added to it. Of course, it's hard to keep secrets at the Atlanta Police Department.
We asked Danny if he made any observations about the nature of the crimes while he was on the stakeout. He immediately thought about the weather that winter, how cold it had been, and how that might have played into the crimes.
And that first killing was honestly the coldest week I have ever experienced in Atlanta. The shooting at the Blue Eagle, that was on Friday night, and we were in the parking lot and the temperature was well below freezing. It was like 27, 28 degrees in the parking lot in the Blue Eagle at 10 o'clock Friday night. And then the temperature stayed down and didn't get above freezing in the daytime for 5 or 6 days in a row. And then it got colder after that. The temperature was not even beating 32, it was 30 or lower. And then at night, the temperature was going well down into the low teens or in the single digits. It was so cold. I have not seen a winter like that since. Things were freezing that normally wouldn't freeze. Ponds were freezing. You're getting a full coat of ice on them. And the sky was just so blue. It was unbelievable.
That also makes me wonder, when it's cold, everyone stays home. They stay in their house.
Unless you're in a car parking, and then you're creating your own heat, which means that there's going to be fewer people out there to interfere with what you're trying to do. Actually, this is a great time for him to do this, because there's nobody else out. People aren't out walking around when it's this cold. And he's probably watched these parks and these areas leading up to this first shooting. This is not the first time he's walked in the park and seen what's going on. This is not a spur of the moment deal that has just, he's decided, hey, I'm going to go out and shoot two people in the park. He's been thinking about this for a while and has probably been planning on it, probably been making some dry runs, walking around, snooping, and figuring out what he's going to do. And the weather is not really going to hinder him that much. He's not going to have to be out there for hours on end to do this. If he's parked nearby, he's going to get out of his warm car, go over here and do it. And besides that, he's going to be so keyed up mentally that the cold's not going to be a factor for him. He's not going to get frostbite and die being outside for 30 or 40 minutes, if it takes that long even. And then he leaves and he goes home.
Danny's observations make a lot of sense. It's like why and how the gunman operated in January and February and March of 1977. But in April, he didn't appear. Not at the staked-out parks. And, as far as APD knew, not in any other area of the city. That meant that Ken Willis and the other reporters, the ones who'd been holding their stories until the stakeout, they would be pushing to publish. There was serious concern, had been serious concern, that the people of Atlanta didn't know the killer was on the loose. And he was hunting in Black Atlanta, where death got the least coverage, where the homicide rates were the highest of any racial demographic in the city. Young Black men and women were the targets, but they couldn't avoid the danger. The APD had tried to catch the killer, and now Ken Willis felt that he'd held up his end of the bargain. It was past time to break the story.
I thought the stakeout was a good idea, but I also thought it's pretty desperate because there are scores of parks in Atlanta. And how do they know that this killer is going to strike in one of these two parks again? How do they know that? I mean, you see in the files that they were on two tracks. They were looking at friends and associates and people like that, right? But most of their work was going into the theory that it was somebody who had access to a policeman's or military person's weapon, right? And it was outside of the community, probably. And how did they know that it was going to, they didn't. And that was my point all along. You've got a very thin theory here. And then when we got to the end of the 5 weeks and 28 days, and they said, well, we think it's now, and now our new theory is every month. It was like, uh-huh, right. That, you know, you're going to come up with something else next time. What police department, what city administration would not want to delay publication of a serial killer if they didn't have the solution? Think about it. In my opinion, they should be protecting the public interest by disclosing that there's a serial killer. But that's not how they think. They think we've got to use every means necessary to solve this crime. And if that means not telling the public or misleading the public, we'll do it. And that, in my opinion, is what happened, or what they tried to do.
Do you think that if you hadn't released the story, you would have gotten clearance to do so from APD eventually?
No. I think they would have liked to either catch the killer in the act or have the story go away. I think that was their plan.
So, after the promised 28 days had passed and the stakeout, with no attacks, Ken Willis decided that the pattern theory wasn't strong enough to hold back the information from the public. He'd have to tell the homicide squad that he was going to run the story in the Constitution, which, as the paper's crime reporter, would have a very direct impact on his relationship with the police.
So first of all, they had hidden the report. They made a deal with us, and after the first interview, reneged. And we came up on the fifth weekend, and nothing had happened, or at least that we knew. And so I said, okay, we're going to run it. And Sergeant Bolton said, I don't think so. And I said, well, it's the fifth weekend. And he said, I don't think so. You need to call Lieutenant Perry. And I said, well, I'm not talking to Lieutenant Perry anymore. If he wants to call my managing editor, he's welcome to. And so he did. And the assistant managing editor on duty on Sunday agreed to hold the story. We had agreed with the managing editor, Jim Minner, on Friday that we were going to run it on Monday morning. And so Minner came in Monday, came over to my desk. He said, what the hell happened? And I said, well, you need to talk to the assistant managing editor because he decided to hold it. He said, I don't need to talk to anybody. We're running that story. And I said, well, what if they kick me out of the police station? He said, don't go. If they arrest you, it makes it a better story. And I said, okay. So we ran the story on Tuesday morning. And the police called a news conference. And the city editor said, you need to go down there and cover that. And I went into Minner's office and I said, well, I think they're going to try to kick me out. And he said, don't go. And I said, really? So I began to think, you know, wait a minute. If I ever decide to get out of journalism and get a real job, and I've been arrested, I have an arrest record, right? And as a journalist, that's sort of a mark of bravery and courage. But as somebody not a journalist, it's, you have to explain it. And so he said, nope, go on down. If they arrest you, they arrest you. It's a better story, like I said. So I got on the elevator, and his boss, the executive editor of both newspapers, the Journal and the Constitution, was on the elevator, and I said, I told him what was going on. We rode 9 floors together, and I said, when Minner told me to not go, he was joking, right? And the executive editor said, yeah. He said, if they want you to leave, leave. Come back here, and we'll deal with it from here. And so I went down there, and of course, they did kick me out. They ushered me out. And I got back to the newspaper. And by that time, the Journal reporter had retrieved the notice banning me from the police station and calling me untrustworthy. So I read it, and I said, that's libel. That's slander. I wasn't suing for that. And the executive editor, the managing editor, and all the paper's lawyers were sitting there and said, no, we're not going to create new libel law over this. But they are letting other reporters in and keeping you out. There's a First Amendment and 14th Amendment calls here, and that's what we're going to stand on. So they notified Maynard Jackson's office that if they didn't let me in by noon on Friday, that they would take them to federal court. And Friday morning, they let me back in. I mean, I was 25, right? And I'm thinking, wow, I wonder if my career is going to be over before it even gets started good. When I was with the Macon Telegraph, I'd had a run-in with private schools in the school desegregation fight. But this was the first time in Atlanta that I'd had a confrontation with somebody. And it, you know, I mean, it's scary to be escorted out of the, most people want to stay out of the police station. I wanted in. And it's scary to be escorted out, and all these cameras were going. I mean, it was the top story on the TV news, and it was like, wow, you know, have I burned my sources forever? You know, will anybody ever talk to me again? You know, did we do the right thing? I looking at it, I couldn't figure out anything else we could have done, because in my mind, we had a duty to do what we did, and so in retrospect, it turned out to be the case. But when you're in the middle of the fight, you wonder sometimes.
If you got to do the whole thing over again, is there any aspect of it that you would change?
If I could, I would push even harder to publish the story when it came to light. That's what I would do. But it was kind of out of my hands. I don't know that I would have done much any differently.
Ken Willis kept reporting on the story, and other reporters joined him at the Constitution and the Journal and the Daily World and on the local nightly news. He did have to write stories about his own expulsion from the press conference, where he was called irresponsible and sensationalist. But Ken let it roll off his back. He focused on the story and stayed on his beat. When we spoke with retired APD Lieutenant Danny Agin about Ken Willis's story and its release, he had this to say.
The police department wanted to trash the press for publishing this report, and I think the report needed to be published, or the story needed to be told.
So that the citizens knew.
Yeah.
They were in danger.
Yeah, people needed to know, and I've personally witnessed this. APD has had a serious problem years ago. I don't know what the case is now. I don't know what's happening. But years ago, the last thing in the world they would have ever wanted to admit is we have a serial offender out here on anything. Rapes, murders, assaults. Serial offender, serial perpetrator was not something they wanted to admit to. And I never understood that. Why was it better to say, well, we've got 12 random crimes where people have been shot or raped, rather than saying we've got 12 crimes we believe are committed by one suspect?
Did they think it reflected poorly on them?
I think it maybe had more to do with the degree of scrutiny and heat that would be turned up knowing that there's a serial offender out here. And then the pressure that was going to come because of all this that would be focused on, you need to do something, you need to get these cases solved. And the pressure doesn't necessarily make the case get solved. I mean, if you can solve it, you solve it, but you can only do so much.
Brooke's point here of why the release of information was so important, so the citizens would know they were in danger, that is the key. Because as soon as Ken Willis published his column, warnings did come out to the public, urging them to avoid the parks, especially the areas where young lovers congregated, and especially at night. An article ran in the Atlanta Constitution on April 20th, 1977, one day after Ken Willis broke the story, and it was entitled, "Stay Out of Dark Parks, Police Say." This article, also written by Ken Willis, who was still on the beat, even as he was persona non grata at the police bureau, was the first direct communication with the public regarding the case. It was also clear how those at the press conference felt about Ken's reporting. That tone is laced through the dissemination of information. Quote, "We're doing everything possible to apprehend the perpetrators of these crimes," Major Joe Amos said at a press conference. He declined to be specific. Per the Constitution, Amos began the conference by denouncing Willis's reporting on the murders. He said, quote, "Because of their desire for a news scoop, the chances of our apprehending the persons responsible for these crimes has seriously been impaired." When a reporter asked just how close they were, Amos replied, "We like to think we're close every second." There was some discussion of the killer's pattern, which, up until April, when the stakeout occurred, had followed a monthly cycle. But there had been no attack in April, which caused Ken Willis to push his story through and inform the public. According to the Constitution, a reporter asked Amos if, quote, "he thought the pattern of the killer had been broken." Per the Constitution, Amos replied, "That depends on the way you look at it." This article introduced several points to the general public they had certainly not heard before, not in Ken Willis's breaking report on the 19th. First, they learned that 6 people had been shot and that 3 had died, though victims and survivors were not listed by name at the news conference. They received basic descriptions of the shooter, The wadcutter ammunition and the theory that the shooter might be in law enforcement, in the military, or similar. Police noted that the suspect was a black male between the ages of 20 and 35, which, to quote Amos, quote, narrows it down to 40,000 suspects in Atlanta. But most strikingly, for the first time, it became apparent that APD had also been consulting with local experts, not just the FBI, as to possible motivations driving the killer. Per Ken Willis, quote, the advice of several psychiatrists has led to theories that the man might be a religious fanatic out to rid the world of sin, or someone who has had a bad experience with a girlfriend. Next time on The Fall Line, those observations, the attempt to further profile the suspect and his motivations, are where we'll pick up the thread of the case, where our guest, a criminology professor, discusses the profiles that were built in the wake of the Atlanta Lovers Lane murder and their usefulness in catching a killer. Thanks for listening. The Fall Line is a fully independent show, and we appreciate listener support. It allows us to do research, obtain FOIAs, pay our content advisors, and support and donate to the causes we care about. If you try out the products we advertise, please use our sponsor codes. It really helps. And if you'd like to support the show and the stories we cover, join us on Patreon. We're raising Patreon funds to continue to fund the Millbrook Twins billboard and to continue to fund therapy for families who've been on the show. You can read a public post about those goals on our Patreon page. Each and every one of our patrons helps us to continue this work, and we're so grateful for your help. On Patreon, you can get early release, ad-free versions of our regular episodes, plus blogs and videos for only $5 a month. We've also added video live streams, which all patrons can enjoy, starting at just a dollar. The Fall Line is written, hosted, and researched by Laura Norton, with additional research by Brian Waters and Kim Fritz. Additional research by Shannon Geary, Haley Gray, and Lexi Newhouse. Interviews by Brooke Hargrove. Produced, engineered, and scored by Maura Curry. Content advisement by Brandy C. Williams, Liv Fallon, and Vic Kennedy. Special thanks to Angie Dodd, Danny Agin, and Ken Willis. Currently, our monthly donation is going to Private Investigations for the Missing. Please join us in supporting this nonprofit. They need funds to help families access the service of PIs.